Hello and welcome. I'm Alexander.
I'm Simon.
And I'm Haney.
We are Native in Tech, covering the latest, in this case, covering the latest from the IT industry, with a specific focus on Microsoft and how to get actual value from technology. This is episode 259, recorded on March the 5th, 2024. You will be able to find this and our previous episodes on nativeintech.com, iTunes, Spotify, and on just about every podcasting platform there is. So this is Feedback Thursday.
Yeah. Or Tuesday.
It depends on if you want to think about this when the episode airs or when it is recorded. But what we mean with that is we have had a number of excellent comments and feedback items on the show, and we've been talking about doing a review of those and the discussion on these for so long, but for some reason it just never did happen. So we're going to go back all the way back to December, where we got one feedback, and then we're going to work on and have conversations about the feedbacks. And one of the really, really large pieces of feedback turned into an interview with Bjorn, where we discussed a lot of interesting things. So I'm kind of thinking that we were going to end up there again with regards to comments, because there's one thing that I haven't told the two of you yet. So we're going to get there.
Yeah. But starting from where it all began, you two did a focus episode back in November, episode 245, where you talked about technical debt.
Yes.
That spawned a lot of feedback. So much feedback that we did an interview with Bjorn, a former colleague of mine. And we'll get back to him later on, because he have provided us with more feedback and opinions, which is good. But I think we have had two focus segments or focus episodes which have caused a lot of feedback. One being the technical debt one, which we'll start with, and then the quality one, which we did just a few weeks ago. But we met a fellow data community member, Thomas Kronawitter. Sorry for mispronouncing it. I need to practice my German again so that I can claim to be half Austrian for real. But he reached out with some really kind words, and he liked the episode, and he wanted to add one aspect, and I will read from his email. First and foremost, thank you for sending it to us. We really appreciate it. He wanted to add one aspect. Like in finance, debt is not necessarily a bad thing. For instance, leasing a car will put you in debt, but at the same time, you're not committing a large amount of your savings to your car. It becomes a problem if the interest and the rates become more than you can handle. In his opinion, the same is valid for technical debt, that it's generally understood that you have to pay up your financial debts. Technical debt need to be paid back as well. This is something business generally do not understand. But they can help you focus on your developers or engineers to deliver something you might not be able to deliver without. It also becomes bad when you cannot pay the interest anymore.
I think that is a very, very good way of putting it. There is nothing intrinsically wrong or dangerous with technical debt. Technical debt is the consequences of unhandled technical debt is going to be an issue.
Yeah. And it's such a fitting example, really. Like, it actually describes the situations better than I would have thought, you know. Yeah. But now put in writing, it describes it quite beautifully. So really nice addition.
Yeah, and isn't like the real, like what really messes up things when it comes to technical debt, isn't that when you do not know that you have it or how it will impact you? Because Alexander now looks very uncertain on what I just said, but like it doesn't matter until it matters. And when you hit that point, you either need to sort it out really, really fast or save on something else, just as in this example. When you start to get higher interest rates, you can cope for a while, until you can't. And then you either have to pay it off to lower the interest, which is usually very cumbersome, or you have to save on other things to be able to continue to pay that loan.
And especially when you hit that tipping point, you're out of options.
Yeah, exactly.
It is no longer an option not to do anything, to put your head in the sand. Are you familiar with the way that buffers work in chemistry?
Oh, that was many, many years ago. I think you'll have to re-educate me, but I knew it at one point.
So a buffer is something that is going to keep, let's say, a pH, acidity. And as long as the buffer can compensate for, if you're adding an acid, i.e. you're decreasing the pH, it is going to stay at a constant level. That's what the buffer does until you reach the tipping point where the buffer can no longer do its thing. And then it is not going to slowly and gently decrease your pH. It is going to drop like a rock. That is sort of kind of what happens with technical debt as well. Because as I said, when you hit the tipping point, you're out of options. And the trick is to not get there. And that brings us to what you just said. Is it really bad if you know it's there? And is it bad if you're not aware? And yes, absolutely. Not knowing that you might be sitting on a ticking bomb, that is generally not conducive to a great night's sleep. So absolutely, first and foremost, surface any issues and don't be scared of them. The only way that you can solve something is by measuring it, right? And I'd have to agree that a lot of companies don't even know that they're facing technical debt. And if they do, they might not even know what they're looking at. They might not have the name for it. And if you don't know what to call it, it's difficult to find it on the internet, and it's difficult to listen to a podcast where they describe it.
Yeah.
See what I did there?
I'm thinking again, so I've stopped listening a while back. But I do still think that we are underestimating. Like, again, if you accept a loan for a car, you are aware of it and you keep following, because before you have the loan, you don't care about the rates.
There's one place where this analogy breaks down. If your income is linear, if your expenses are linear, I mean, if everything is absolutely stable, then you're fine.
Yeah.
But that is rarely the case with technical debt, because there are so many things that can shift so quickly.
Yeah.
Then again, hello, inflation. That definitely put a spanner in the works for a lot of families, even without leases on a car. But I think that is, it's a good analogy, but just like any other analogy, it will break down if you look closely enough. But it's a good way of looking at it, I think.
Yeah, I think it does also point out like an important aspect that it is, in terms of a loan, it is oftentimes better to, you know, have a consistent plan on how to tackle it. And like, what happens if something goes wrong? And I do think the same is true for technical debt as well. We should have some kind of strategy to how do we deal with it? How do we, what do we do if something unexpected comes up? And things like that. So we should be prepared, not only acknowledge that it's there, but actually think about what do we do with this situation.
And we're back to the buffer. I think this is where a lot of businesses fail or haven't even thought of it. Because if you, it's like money. If you have a buffer of, let's just say, $1 million, there's a lot of weird shit that can happen. And you're going to go, that's unfortunate, but I can cope with it because I have my buffer. If that was a thing from a technical standpoint, and this is me thinking at the same time as I'm talking, I have no idea how I would implement this, but the mindset, that would definitely help in a situation like this.
But isn't that very like true. We will be talking about DevOps when we get together in London in a while. as I see it, the challenge a lot of IT departments have today with technical debt is that they are required to be innovative at the same time as budgets are getting cut due to inflation and everything else that's happening. So you take away all the time and resources that you previously could have thrown at the buffer. And now you don't have it anymore. Because not because it's you have always been able to pay that extra interest rate because you've had the time, you've had the money, you have coped, and now you don't have enough income to pay. And then you can't do something with it because you don't have the resources to even work it off. Because you have no income. You need to save on things you can't save on.
No, and this is where we're, if that was in a financial discussion, people would start doing short-term high-interest loans.
Exactly.
Which is the death spiral.
Yeah, but isn't that what people are doing, especially within cybersecurity? Let's buy something that will solve everything for us, something that's automatic or whatever it might be. But they don't realize that even like an automated solution needs internal knowledge. They are throwing money at it to sort something out short term. And like, let these people do it. Just throw money at it and we can focus on paying off the technical debt or just eating pizza.
Yeah. I don't know if I got a little lost with the analogy there in the previous part, but I do think I got your point nonetheless. But what I wanted to add is that I would, though, maybe a little bit disagree that even in times when like the everything is going well in the business and everything like that, there are situations where people find themselves in like that threshold area of technical debt. And it's not always just, you know, there's no time and funds to do something. It is sometimes also just how the work is directed. And I think that's what Bjorn was also, when he was as a guest, he was pointing out that, you know, we do need to allocate some of our work time to also addressing not falling over that threshold and not just kind of feel, just leave it like, oh, well, maybe we will be fine and maybe we won't, and leave it to chance.
Cool. Are we done with the technical debt for now? So again, thank you so much, Thomas, for sending in that feedback. We really appreciate it. And sorry for not picking up on it until now, but just as Santa Claus, we read all of your emails.
So I just want to add to that. We read it the moment it came in, and it has kept coming up.
Yeah.
And we've talked about these things before pressing record. So I think all the bits and pieces taken together, we probably have or should have had a complete episode on the topic previously. But yes, but we have now.
Yeah. So the next listener's email is from Bart Jacobs. He has reached out to us on Twitter and such before, and I love how he starts his email. Now I must say there have been other episodes that I have been meaning to write to you about. We appreciate that, but this particular episode, number 256 about quality, he just simply couldn't let go. So again, this feels like some kind of teenage social thingy on public TV. But I will read from his email. as some of you might remember, I struggled to explain what I thought and felt about this topic. And Bart could hear my struggle, and he felt the same way at the beginning. And then it hit him that we were not talking about quality, but actually about the level of quality. Think about it. When you say quality, you actually mean good quality. The good part just gets dropped. But you're talking about the level, not the quality itself. And then he has a few examples. Build quality of cars, which I think we talked about, and which I think is a great way of explaining it, can be measured by the width of the gap between body panels and doors. No, some of you know the brand
of car. I feel like this is pointing somewhere.
we'll leave it at that. But what good quality means to a brand like, say, Ford is probably not acceptable.
Or
accessible
Tesla.
For a... yeah. Agreed. For a brand like Mercedes. So when talking about car build quality, you're talking about the level of quality, not the quality itself. Software is the same thing. You could argue that the quality can be measured by the closeness to zero for the number of bugs. With an unlimited time and budget, you will get better level of quality. But for a one-off script, 10 bugs can just be fine. So the level of quality is in the eye of the beholder. It's personal. Just like Haney put out there in the definition, the quality itself can be measured. And he doesn't agree that you need to talk to project managers about it. They should not oversee the level of quality. They need to be guardians of timelines, planning, and communication. Putting project managers in charge of the level of quality implies they decide on technical trade-offs. I've never seen a project manager make a sound technical decision, and have been doing this for some time. You can say many things about the latest episode, that being episode 256, but it sure got me thinking. And I want to conclude this feedback by saying that I applaud the audio-only format. Listening to an audio podcast when they explain a PowerPoint. Well, you can answer that yourself, I guess. So thank you, Bart, for that amazing feedback. What is your thoughts on it, Alexander and Haney?
So I think he puts into words what a lot of us were thinking. And as you read this, and I read this as well, it came back to me that was kind of my thing. You cannot measure what quality is not it's not a quantifiable object by itself. It needs to be compared to something, and that brings us to level of quality and also how do you measure level of quality? We're back to that. That is always going to be difficult. And let's keep going with the example, number of bugs. I'd argue that the quality of the product can be absolutely horrendous, even if we have 0 bugs. And it can be phenomenal with 1 billion bugs. Probably not, but yeah. So it's ephemeral. It's so difficult to grasp. And as soon as we're stuck in trying to decide on what do we mean with good quality, we're not going to get anything done.
No.
So it's more important to figure out and stick to definitions. They might not be the best ever, but they are something to talk about. So everybody knows that we're on the same page, and then we can change or improve those definitions as we go. But it's more important to get something in writing that we can agree on, I think.
Yeah, I definitely agree with all of that. I also got stuck thinking about I think the number of bugs is just one example for like how we could measure the level of quality. And yeah, I do think like it's completely correct. Of course, when we talk about quality, we talk about mainly like we want to aim for good quality. But as said, like what is that in the specific context? Because I also think that in a software development context, it is quite different than a data platform context, where it's maybe more focused on the quality of data. Is it actually the right values and things like that? Whereas in a software development context, it might be more about the user experience and there being less bugs and so forth for the user. So it's quite a difference, I believe, within different contexts.
And I want to throw in a bit of a grenade. I can't remember if we talked about this, but relative quality. So 1,000 bugs is exactly that. It's 1,000 bugs. Is that good or bad? No, I don't know, but it's 1,000 bugs. If it was 10 bugs yesterday, then 1,000 bugs today is probably not a indicator of a good thing or good quality.
No.
But it was 9,000 bugs yesterday. Mm. Then 1,000 bugs is pretty damn good. Mm-hmm. So yeah. We're back to measuring things and also using some relative yardstick, mm-hmm. if you will.
It also came to my mind that, you know, within different industries, there is very different kind of tooling and software available. And within some areas, the tooling and software might not be very modern and easy to use and fast, mm-hmm. and things like that. So if you, for example, were to bring a new software to that area and it is faster and less better to use than all the previous options, you will be like, wow, this is amazing quality. Like, this is so much better. Even though, like, compared to something we use in the IT field, it might be just like average. But if it's compared to the other tooling that is available, if it's much better, then you will feel like, oh my gosh, I have the best thing in the world to use right now.
Yeah. And two things that I quote there was, the first thing being, one vendor that I work with, whenever they do presentations, the first thing they start with is to throw up their competitors on the screen and say, this competitor really had this many CVEs last year. This vendor has this many CVEs last year. And we had this few CVEs last year. And I think that, to your point, Alexander, okay, but if you have had a constant number of those, you aren't improving. You're still writing the same kind of code. But if the others, yes, they might be higher, but some of them also have a substantially higher market share and are therefore probably more attacked and tried to breach than you are. It's a number that doesn't say anything other than you have fewer than they have. But if you have severity 9 CVEs, it doesn't matter. I think that's the one thing. The other thing is that, honest question to you, Alexander. We have the same kind of car. We have a Tesla Model 3. Would you consider that to be good quality?
So that is a very good question. And that depends on what you mean.
Exactly.
Let's stick with the body panels. They cannot put that car together if their life depended on it.
No.
It's insane. Mm-hmm. The quality of the components seem to be very, very good.
Yeah.
The quality of the interior is not very, very good. So it depends.
Yeah. But like, you, at least I love my car. I am totally fine with the body panels being put on, like my, and it could have been my 7-year-old that put them on. And all the other things that are things that non-Tesla owners look at and say, yeah, it's bad quality. But to me, it doesn't matter. Because I value all the other things. And then obviously quality or build quality or good build quality does not matter because I love the darn thing.
And that is a really good example of one of the inherent issues with quality.
Mm-hmm.
Because I agree. This is the best car I've ever had.
Yeah.
There are times when I just want to drive it off a cliff. But that was also the case with a number of my other cars. Mm-hmm. Looking at you, Volvo, and BMW, and Volkswagen. But as you just said, you accept a lot of the quirky things. That brings us to the relative value and what I can expect. If this was a Mercedes, there is no way that I would even consider accepting the car in the shape it was. Mm-hmm. That's just no, because I've come to expect and paid a premium for a Mercedes.
Yeah.
Mm.
But I'm paying almost the same money for
more.
A new Model 3 that I'm paying for a... So where did that go? So in many ways, I find it very peculiar that we are really moving the goalpost and we're not holding Tesla to anywhere near the same standard as we are holding a Mercedes. And there's so many excuses. Well, they're not really a car company. They build computers with wheels and so on and so forth. But at the end of the day, here we have a car that costs a lot of money that is skimping on what we see as basic features and basic put togetherness, if that is a word.
Oh, yes.
And I think all that brings us back to the point that also Bart wrote in his email, that the level of quality is in the eye of the beholder. It always is.
And with that said, it's more of, so I value X, you value Y, i.e. that's in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that is a great segue to our last listener's email, because Björn have been emailing us again. First and foremost, he loves the episode. But you are three techies. Thank you. That's a compliment. Talking from the perspective of techies. Hashtag love. I've been on the dark side, aka sales, for about 10 years on and off. Quality is subjective. You can't define it. And by trying to define it, you force a round peg into a square hole. Subjective is good sometimes, but as coming from a technical background, that hurts because it's not black or white. It will be different for different people.
Exactly my point. Mm. We need to decide on and agree on what we mean when we say good quality.
And then we get into the challenge. Can a person with no technical knowledge decide what's good quality or not? Which Bart also said about product managers, but in many of our cases, it's usually some kind of manager that asked someone, we need to get a data platform person to set this up. And you can write as many statements of works and things as you like, and in the end, someone might complain. But they might not have the experience or knowledge or even insight into saying this is good or bad. And Haney is super excited about going next. So go ahead.
Yeah, let's see if I can put what's in my mind into words, because it's kind of hard to grasp. Mm-hmm. But if we think about it, we always have some kind of end user to whatever solution, whether it's software, a data platform, or something like that. And a lot of the times that is the user whose sense of quality matters, because they will be either using the service or not. And of course, most of the time, if they're not, well, you're not maybe going to get so much money for providing that service. So that is the quality that matters, that is kind of displayed outside, not necessarily outside. The users could be internal users as well, but, you know, to the end users. Mm. And then there's the factor that do the technical decisions that are made behind the scenes kind of provide and support that quality that is then experienced by the user?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they might or they might not. Mm. I don't actually think that quality is just a technical matter. Only. That's just my sense. There's other aspects to it. Many, many other aspects. But it is definitely something that depends on the nature of the service that you are creating. And really the quality that matters. Well, also other kinds of quality matter. But, you know, if you find from the perspective of you have a business and that business actually needs to have some income and be profitable, you know, that is the quality then that can impact that aspect and does your company and service keep running. So the end users, whether they're internal, external, kind of their sense of quality in the end is the most important. And then you have to figure out how do the other things that build up that sense of quality, how do they affect that? So the technical decisions, your ways of working, because your ways of working can, for example, affect how fast can you resolve bugs, for example, or your practices on how you monitor data quality. It doesn't actually show directly to the end user, but it could be something that then affects their experience of using the platform. Potentially, but potentially not. So you need to figure out what are the aspects that affect that. And I'm not sure if that made any sense, because I was kind of thinking as I spoke.
I think that that could also be the name of this podcast, Thinking As We Speak, or Speaking As We Think.
True. No, but you're putting your head on the nail again, and you're thinking like an architect, because what you're describing is a holistic view of whatever we're dealing with. And I had an interesting conversation with a very dear friend of mine who works for a huge telecommunications company, which is not Telia, by the way. And
there isn't anyone else.
We might consider having her on. Yep. That one is a very smart cookie. And we talked about holistic views. And she said that most people, and I tend to agree, find it very, very difficult to keep a big picture in their head. So difficult, in fact, that they just go, no, I'm going to focus on what I understand and just ignore the rest. And it is kind of scary when you raise your eyes and take a look around and see how many people who do exactly that and how few people that take a moment or lots of moments to stop and really think of the whole landscape. That is hard. That is really hard. But that is, in my view, the only way to optimize all aspects. So a holistic view for sure.
That is actually something we should do a focus segment on, because that has been something that's been following me for my entire career. Because I've always been an architect and always felt very proud of being an architect. But I've met so much pushback on being an architect in my years, because I apparently doesn't know enough of anything. That's why I'm an architect and not a senior expert or something like that.
No, and this kind of brings us to the question around, can a project manager make decisions on quality? Mm-hmm. Well, can an architect make decisions on anything?
Yeah.
I would argue in both cases a resounding yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And just like project management is a skill in and of itself, architecture is a skill in and of itself. Haney is a living proof of that.
Yep.
Then she just happens to be unreasonably well-versed in just about anything she touches, but that's...
Exactly. Some people are just great at everything they do, and I'm not at all jealous.
Apart from OneNote.
Apart from OneNote.
So this conversation can go on and on and on. We are, again, out of time. But I'm really looking forward to having these kinds of discussions more, because this was really, really, really exciting and really useful. And I'll reach out to my friend Maya to have a discussion around quality. Hey, I'm already thinking ahead. Discussion about architecture. And also, we will be having a conversation with Koen Verbeek in the future. So when I'm back from Vegas, we're going to have him on and talk fabric.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Sounds great.
Indeed. The next episode that will come out will be from SQL Bits, and it will be the live recording at SQL Bits. I am reasonably sure that we will have a lot of content from SQL Bits, but that will be the next proper episode. Since I'm going to be in the U.S., the week after, I don't think I'll have time to do the mixing and stuff. So there might be a week delay before the next episode comes out. But rest assured, there are lots of interesting things in the pipeline.
For sure.
And a huge thank you to everyone who has sent us feedback. It's amazing to actually get that and get like additional views to the topics. It's super, super important and valuable. So thank you, and please keep sending more feedback.
That works over email or direct messages on Twitter or LinkedIn.
Or stone tablets or smokes. It doesn't matter. We'll make it work.
All of the above.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Until the next episode, thank you so much for listening. And we can't wait to see people in person at SQL Bits. Mm-hmm. So really, really looking forward to that. And I hope we see you there. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Knee Deep in Tech. Knee Deep in Tech is a bi-weekly technology podcast hosted by Alexander Arvidsson, Simon Binder, and Heini Hilmarinen. If you have any feedback, questions, or would like to be part of an episode, please reach out to us on social media or via email at podcast@kneedeepintech.com.